Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
I love doing it.
Francis Albert Sinatra, known as the chairman of the board. I have this visual in my head of him with in a tuxedo with his bow tie undone, right? With a cigarette and his scotch in his hand, right? Singing on stage like that. He was pretty much...
It wouldn't have been the first time.
He was pretty much the man in his day. Speaking of the summer wind, we're going to talk about the... Summer wind that blew into Normandy 75 years ago today, and joining me are Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny. Men, how you doing? Jeff, how you doing?
Very good, Matt. How are you?
I'm all right, man. I'm all right. I spent the evening a couple nights ago with 3rd Battalion 25th Marines out at Camp Wilson in the Chow Hall. Never thought I'd see that place again, and... It was awesome. Yeah, it was awesome. It was awesome. And
yep.
A bunch of those guys came up and said, hey, and that they listen. And a few of them mentioned you two guys. So no, it was good. I'm all right. Timmy, how are you?
Doing just fine, brother. Doing just fine. I appreciate you having us back on.
You bet. You bet. What, 75 years ago, Normandy. So, Jeff, start with you. When you think of Normandy, what do you think of?
Well, I mean, I always thought about the since the mid '80s when I think about Normandy, the simple plan, you know, in a operational way, the idea of blocking off the beachhead by doing a night amphibious or airborne assault with 24,000 paratroopers in order to protect the beachhead so that the five beaches could get lodgements that could be held, and how simple that is in conception, but how horrifically difficult it was in execution. You know, that's what I think of.
All right, Timmy, how about you?
I think of innovation. The first thing I think of is Navy destroyers. Violating their standing ROE, recognizing that things are going bad on Utah Beach and coming in close and dueling with cannon emplacements without coordinating with inability to coordinate ashore. I mean, it was just a bunch of initiative where one destroyer took it. I believe it was the O'Brien, and then a bunch followed. But you think about that. You think about the Mulberries. You think about the deception and using Patton to fix Hitler and Rommel on the Pas de Calais, the short route. It was a pretty ingenious damn plan that went in a year too late. In my humble opinion, it should have launched in August of 43 and taken advantage of the fact that the Germans just weren't there in strength then. They were still being tied by the Soviets and getting a bus handed to them out there.
I think of as I've learned more now, I think of just the transformation of the United States to produce everything that needed to be produced for ourselves, for the Brits, and then Tim, before we came on, Tim was talking about what we were producing for the Russians, and then to include what we were sending out to the Pacific, but just the transformation of a nation, the United States, that had never done anything like this in its history, right? I mean, we marginally played in World War I towards the end, and then World War II comes up, and we essentially supply the world with military hardware, and then we expand from really very small standing military to a huge military, to the nation under arms. I mean, you just think about that, and I mean, I won't say that Normandy was a culmination, because obviously victory is a culmination, but Normandy is an incredible feat of arms. And when you look at, whether you look at the maps or whatever you look at, to kind of take a look at it, where they took off from, where they left ports from all the different ports on the southern side of England, to ultimately how they go ashore. I mean, it's an amazing story. But that, I think of how, I mean, just the total effort of the nation, and Normandy is a choke point. Normandy is a choke point. And so I get that in my head.
There's certainly a great happenstance of fortune in history, in that the years from like 1890 up till through the First World War, the Industrial Revolution, how it manifests itself in the United States with the huge factories turning out motor vehicles that workers could afford and use to pursue their own financial wherewithal, which necessitated the railroads expanding, necessitated the buildup of highways and roads and so forth, which produced more jobs, which produced more ideas. And then the idea of, right after World War I, the idea of actually moving people around by air. And our people were on the cutting edge of that, because the war that happened between 1914 and 1918 absolutely gutted Western Europe and had a huge negative effect on Eastern Europe also, and that it caused the unrest that resulted in communism and so forth, so that they didn't have that phenomenon that we had. I mean, even though the Depression lasted longer for us than them, still the huge infrastructure we had put together was easily converted to the war making potential that made us save the world in World War II, I think.
Yeah, pretty amazing, pretty amazing. Is there any part of the operation itself going ashore in Normandy that you find any more fascinating than any other part, Tim?
Well, the part that's recreated on Saving Private Ryan, where you see that boat coming ashore and drop the thing.
Let me ask you a question. Did the whole Saving Private Ryan, did that thing ever happen?
No, I was just reading about that.
Not that, but the landing sequence was based off of the Utah beach at that one critical draw that they had to seize that had the only hardball coming off the beach.
I'm talking about, did we launch guys to go yoke one dude?
No, that's no. That was a play off the Sullivan Brothers, right, is where that idea came from. But the landing sequence depicted the actual landing that I think it was the Reserve Division took right in front of that critical draw.
The second Rangers had a company that was supposed to land and then go and reinforce Point Du Hoc, and they got thrown into that Dog 1, Dog 2 area, and that did happen. That's where, that company from 2nd Ranger Battalion was. That happened.
That's exactly right. I was going to say that.
So what's that
landing sequence, which was so well done on film, according to Alex Hollings, in fact, validated by Alex, who I enjoy listening to, by the way. But that landing sequence, when you think about how they had to fight off that damn draw, it was some pretty impressive close combat. And again, innovation by guys on the ground making decisions in the face of utter friggin' chaos, to include destroyer captains coming in and shelling some of these.
Well, things. How the fuck are those pillboxes still alive in existence? Like, what the hell, man?
Oh, now we're getting into some of the pre-planning that was sort of screwy. Did you know, for instance, that you lost two squadrons of close air support because the Brits did not want to be responsible for causing French casualties?
Right. They bombed the French by mistake. They missed the beach.
I'm talking about before. So you didn't have as much air hitting that beach as it was supposed to be because of some of that was weather and whatnot. But a lot of that was nixed in the planning when the Brits said, no, we're not going to do that. You're going to kill too many civilians.
And the idea was to drop bombs on the beach, too, so that the guys would have at least some kind of cover when they got, off the landing craft. You know,
exactly.
Yeah, but how with all those naval guns, does somebody with a 16-inch rifle or a 5-inch rifle or an 8-inch rifle not smoke those shore batteries?
Oh, I think the naval guns hit repeatedly by 8-inches and still were cranking out rounds. It wasn't like they didn't know about that kind of crap, apparently.
Right. I know. In fact, Colleen was watching Saving Private Ryan with her class, and so she came home, and I said, "Well, do you want to watch it with me? And I can explain some of that to you." And she said, "Oh, okay. You know, why are those metal things in the water?" Well, this is why. What are they looking for? Well, they're looking for this. What are those guys trying to do? Well, when they say cover fire, you're not supposed to stop shooting when the guys run, but that's just stupid movie shit. And so she's like, "Oh, really?" I'm like, "Yeah." So I was watching it, and they get to the beach, and the movie depicts those gun emplacements as still actively shooting during the assault. I thought, is that true?
Yes. Really? I thought those were just machine guns up there in the.
No, they had some 88s and some other rifles. But real quick, let me read to you a quick quote. This is from the Royal Air Force Chief of Staff, Air Staff. On 12 April, the general complained, "It now develops that our plan for bombarding certain transportation centers may involve such a loss of French life that the British cabinet is objecting to part of the plan. This prevents the CAS from placing the two bomber forces under my command. I protested bitterly at allowing details of a few targets to interfere with the operations of the whole plan," but that was part of the reason why that was ignored. That contributed to some of the less than adequate prep by the air.
Was that Lee Mallory, Timmy, or is that Butch, or is that Harris?
That's Harris's staff. I don't know who it was that quote came from. I got it off a U.S. Naval Institute article.
A.K.A. Yeah. Butcher Harris.
They're taking the statue down.
Enthusiastic killer of civilians, man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're taking the statue down because of that. That guy was tough.
Oh, they
man.
Shouldn't do that, man. They shouldn't do that.
Jeff, what about you? Any part of the operation itself fascinate you more than any other part?
Yeah, I'm still. I'll tell you what. I'm fascinated with the whole idea about infantry combat, where you're using suppression to get angles and ground to kill the enemy and to take ground, and that's the best I've ever seen that in a movie. Is that scene there, the first battle scene where they're fighting to get up that draw and to get behind that machine gun emplacement? And in truth, those guys got up there and they did it pretty much the same way—a mixed bag of guys from 2nd Rangers, guys from the 116th Regiment, which was a regiment in the 29th Division. Two assault divisions that hit Omaha was the Big Red 1 and the 29th Division. And so when those guys took that thing and they fried those guys in that machine gun bunker, and also I guess there was a gun emplacement in there, they actually took 8 prisoners from in there after they burned them. And but to me, that's the most fascinating part of the first thing. And plus, by the time I saw Private Ryan, I had been in action myself in Liberia, and that sound of the rounds smacking the walls and everything around us was exactly the way it was. I never saw a movie that was that much like real life than that. And then, of course, when Band of Brothers came out and Black Hawk Down and, the Pacific, that is the same type of, same type of special effects. But that was, I got to give it to Dale Dye for that one, for the way he trained those guys. And also the weapons. That also fascinates me. Now, the whole idea of fire team, they were doing basically what the Marine Corps stumbled on during Guadalcanal. A guy with a BAR, a couple guys with M1s, after we got the M1 after Guadalcanal, after the Springfield was replaced. And the idea that these guys could suppress and move forward and basically chew their way towards the enemy. And if you're not... That's why I'm not a big one-shot, one-kill guy, because my experience is sometimes the only thing that saves your ass is the steel you put out. Little bits of supersonic cover is what they really are that you're generating yourself. And that movie was good for showing that, especially when they're going up that draw there. To me, that was really, it was really good. That Thompson, There's three versions of the Thompson. The first one was the 1921 version, which is the one that, and you can tell the difference between the 1921, the 1928, and the 1942. Pretty much the best way to look at it is the muzzle flash suppressor, what type they had. And probably the best operating Thompson of the three is the 1928 Thompson, which is the one you see the Marines have on Guadalcanal with the old telephone receiver type, flash suppressor. But the one that Tom Hanks had was balls accurate for those guys going into World War II in that theater. It was the 1942 Thompson. A lot of parts were consolidated, so it was a simpler action, a little bit slower rate of fire. And, I enjoyed and I appreciate the dedication to accuracy and small details about infantry, you know?
Have you ever fired that weapon?
Yeah. And when I was in Iran on embassy duty, we had the successor. We had 8 M3 grease guns, which was not as good as the Thompson, but a lot easier to take apart and put together. And when you shot it, it was like it felt when you shot one round like you were firing 2 or 3 rounds, because the whole action, big heavy action, would come sliding back, ba-boom, ba-boom, and it was real slow rate of fire. I swear to God, I thought you could see those 45 rounds going down range, you know. But I did fire that the 1942 Thompson, and it was similar to that, but a little bit faster rate of fire.
Timmy, you ever fire the Thompson?
Oh yeah, I fired the Thompson. I had all three variations of the grease gun in Afghanistan. I got them from trading beer to the NDS guys in Kabul. All three versions. Yeah, those things are real slow cyclic rate, real easy to control your on automatic, but a completely unsafe piece of gear.
Oh yeah. Explain to people what NDS is. That's interesting.
NDS is the Afghan National Directive of Security, and Afghanistan is a repository for all kinds of guns. German World War II guns, shit tons of them around there. And of course, there was a lot of grease guns. Apparently we had given to them. I'm not sure when or where or why, but we had apparently dumped a considerable number of grease guns on Afghanistan, and, those found their way out to the contractors pretty easily, but they were Afghanistan's a place that's kind of awash in all kinds of military weapons.
Yeah, we would find weapons, and guys would report what they found in a cache that they found, and you would say, this is a Mauser, and you're like, what?
It's a museum.
Yeah, we've uncovered
a museum.
Yeah, can you bring that down here? And like, what are you doing with it? No, we're not taking it down there. I will tell you this, I can recall my son's watching Saving Private Ryan, and they said, "Hey, Dad, do you want to watch this with us?" And I was like, I don't know. I don't know that I would really want to watch that. And then I sat down and watched the first 10 minutes, and I said, "That's too real, boys. That is, right? I mean, it's the audio. It's the sounds, right? Yeah. The sound of it, you're like, holy shit." And there, you know, my son's listening, they're like, what? I said, those are these sounds.
Yeah.
And you know how your ear knows it? And all of a sudden you hear it, you're like, wow. No, I mean, the technical advisory stuff and the audio stuff they did is absolutely, absolutely amazing. I interviewed a guy, and I played the interview in the first hour. His name's Harris Holman, and it was an impromptu interview that I did, I want to say, in 2001. So it had been before September 11th. And I was looking for somebody. It was really, one of the interesting things about doing like a local radio show is all the different people that you have in your community that were, you know, that were part of these events. And so, everybody who I wanted to interview, I wanted to interview people from my community that had been on the beaches at Normandy. And there's still enough of them around. And so I called the VFW and I called the Legion, and everybody, every name they gave me, it's like, it's Memorial Day, they're at the lake. And I couldn't get anybody. So I go on the air and I said, hey, I'm looking for somebody who was at Normandy. So if you know somebody, call me during the break. So we took a break. Phone rings. It's a woman. She said, my dad was there. I said, what's his name? She said, Harris Holman. And he's in an assisted living facility in Hatton, North Dakota. And if you call down there, I'm sure he would love to do it. I call down there, and he speaks with the whole, like, Norwegian brogue thing, right? Yeah, you know, all that.
He's like a Fargo character.
Oh, my God.
That's what I was thinking.
No. He's not like that. He's like he's from a foreign country, not the Minnesota, North Dakota kind of thing. So I introduced myself, asked him if he'd like to do it, and he said, yeah. And I said, okay, I got to run to the studio. Harris, what was your rank? He said, well, I got out as a sergeant. I was a squad leader sergeant at Normandy. And I said, who are you with? And he said, I was with the 75th Ranger Regiment. And I said, okay. So now the commercials are, the break's ending, and I hang the phone up, and I'm running down the hallway, and I'm thinking, Jesus Christ, he probably went up the cliffs at Point du Hoc.
Well,
shut up for a second. So anyway, yeah, you got to have me on this interview, this segment, just so everybody knows. So I'm running to the studio. I pick it up, and this whole thing is an impromptu meeting. And he went up the cliffs at Point du Hoc, and he talked about their training. He talked about what it was like to be in the landing craft off the shore. He got wounded three different times. He met General Patton on a couple occasions. He saw his brother on the beach at Normandy.
Wow.
His brother was a tanker. He said, and who do you think comes driving by but my brother, Rudy. And so it's unbelievable, the story that he tells about. I said, so what did you take up those cliffs? He said, we took our rifles and hand grenades. We were going to get them by surprise. And, boy, we got them by surprise. Because, you know, we knew we could do it. I said, well, you guys a tough bunch? He said, we were a tough bunch. We had our pick of anybody. And, I mean, you know, the whole country under arms. And he said, we were good. And you know, so he tells us, and it's one of my favorite interviews. But that now, because of that interview, I've always been. I'd seen the pictures and I'd read a little bit about that, but you know, the Rangers going up that cliff.
So he's been to reunions and shit since then.
He's never gone back. I asked him if he'd ever been back, and he said he got kind of emotional. He said, no, my blood is on that place. I cannot go back. He said,
he's a bunch of Rangers though, right?
I don't know. I don't think he never went back.
He was when it was too late for him.
Fifth Ranger Battalion.
Too bad he's not. We can't sort him out now, because what a shame for him to miss that. Because what an accomplishment. Oh my God.
Because the 75th Ranger Regiment didn't get started till like the 50s. But what they did was they brought those guys in. They said, you guys were in the 2nd Ranger Battalion and the 6th Ranger Battalion. That's the guy who did the rescue at Santoy, Simon. He was a 6th Ranger Battalion guy. The guys who did the liberation of the POWs there in the Philippines. They said, all you guys are battalions in the 75th Ranger Regiment, because there was no Ranger Regiment then. You know, and they just had the separate battalions that did stuff. And the guys who did most of the work at Normandy were 2nd Ranger Battalion, commanded by a guy named Lieutenant Colonel Rudder, and then that they're supported by the 5th Ranger Battalion. Say, hey, look, Rudder, man, whatever you're doing, let me know how I can help you. Because he had, you know, skilled guys, too. Yeah, they had a horrific time there in Normandy, for sure.
Yeah, when I hear the interview, in fact, the North Dakota Museum of History, you know, contacted me and wanted to get their hands on the interview. And so they sent me this form that I would sign, they emailed me this form that I would sign over all rights to the interview to them. And I emailed the guy back and I said, are you stupid? Why would you send this to me? I said, I'll allow you to use it.
Yeah.
He goes, oh, I'm sorry. I'm like, yeah, don't be stupid.
I wonder what did that.
Yeah, no, it's like, what the fuck? Anyway, but so probably for personal reasons, you know, and then he passes away.
Somebody breaks into his daughter's house and takes all of his shit.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Man.
Yeah, and they, to my knowledge, they've never, ever found it. Yeah, all of his, he had his haversack from, from his fighting, and he said, I have 3 bullet holes through it. And, he had his medals, and I can't remember what else, but, yeah, it was just a shitty story. Is there, we talked about, in thinking about Normandy, could anything like that, could we do anything like that today in terms of industrial capacity, in terms of, they controlled the media, right?
Yeah.
I mean, now you would hear, hey, all the trucks are moving to various, harbors on the east, on the southern side of England, a lot of activity. You would hear those as news reports.
The press colluded with the military.
All right, hold on, stop. Move your mouth away from the microphone.
Oh, so sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
I said the press not only didn't out the plans, they colluded with the plans.
Right. I mean, so the question is, how would we do anything like that today? Could we?
No. Because remember, Normandy, at the same time a week later, you've got Saipan going on the other end of the world, and we're keeping Russia in a fight almost single-handedly through Lend-Lease. All this happening simultaneously, there's not a chance in hell we could ever do that again.
And the whole army, they made a big push through Cassino at the same time and took Rome like 2 days before.
Exactly right. Italy was gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I think that... it's all relative to the enemy, Max. So I don't. We were constrained by the Germans were the best thing going, as far as mechanized and combined arms and everything, until they showed us how to beat them, and we did beat them, But when it comes to the capacity to do something like that, as far as I think the technology today would move into the. To the prohibitive lethal zone too quick. In other words, nukes, to do something like that. There's no way that, I think if we had nukes, you use them instead of attacking Iwo Jima if we had them earlier. And I think if we had a nuke in 1944, we might not have had to do Normandy. You understand what I'm saying? So, because, it was appalling casualties for normal, for normal representative democracy folks, it was almost too, bad for the Russians. I mean, after Stalingrad, Stalin actually made overtures to Hitler to fucking work out a deal. And all that shit came out in those Venona tapes that came out in the 90s after the Soviet Union fell. And Hitler said, no fucking way. I hate you too much. I'll just attack you again sooner or later. Or you me. And that's true. That's true, correspondence. So I guess what I'm saying is, I think the conditions for these things, a horrific accident, that makes something like that possible. If we had to invade somebody now, I guess we're talking China. And I think we'd just expand into lethality, the expanding, chain reaction to the point where it'd be prohibitive. I don't know I don't think we got this, the resolve for that, And we certainly don't have we're not ready industrially. Maybe ready technologically wise, but, I don't know if we're ready to do that.
I don't know. You look at just the industrial output. You look at the control of the media. You might be right. I mean, that's a bygone day. It was war for that period in our history, and a large war, would certainly, Or I don't know. I mean,
one of the big papers right before the D-Day, I think it was in May, said, we know that we're going to invade northern France here in the beginning of June. I don't know if you remember that, Tim. You remember?
And what Roosevelt did, I do. And I believe the Germans thought it was propaganda. It was
because there was no reaction to it. Like, there were no mass arrests. There are no hangings like there would have been in Nazi Germany. You know, there's no reaction. So they just thought, oh, it's bullshit. But it wasn't bullshit, you know?
Interesting.
So,
what about, as an American, you learn American history, you know, and one of the things you learn is that, you know, we land on Normandy and then we defeat the Germans a year and less than a year later. You know, we landed 44 and the war in Europe is over in May of 45. And I was shocked to begin to read, you know, the history of the Eastern Front. And when you read about the scale of fighting that took place on the Eastern Front, you look at Normandy, I think, a little bit differently. I saw yesterday that the Russians, made the point of commenting on Normandy, saying, yeah, that was not a decisive event in the Second World War. Timmy, where do you put Normandy in the big box of the Second World War?
There's no question that Germany was on her knees on the Eastern Front by 1944, just as there's no question that the Soviets have always maintained that our contributions were insufficient, inadequate, and too little too late. That there's nothing unusual about that. But there is no doubt that our activities in the Mediterranean, which I don't think in retrospect were smart. I think we should have gone right for Germany. But our activities and ability to project forces, possibly in Norway, possibly down into the Balkans, possibly into France and whatnot, tied up a significant amount of the Wehrmacht and contributed directly to their ultimate defeat. But there's no doubt that they were on their ass when we landed. But had they reinforced in time, they could have made that a touch and go situation. If Hitler hadn't specifically on the 12th of June prohibited the Panzers from going north and dealing with it because he thought Patton was coming across the way to Pas-de-Calais, and had those Panzers been thrown into it, dude, that Normandy landing, that could have been a meat grinder from hell.
Jeff, where do you put Normandy in the big box of?
Decisive. All the stuff that we did in the Second World War was as decisive as anything that happened on the damn Russian front. It's a slaughterhouse, man. You know, there's two cycles went at each other, and a lot of stupid, you know, the whole idea of trying to swallow up Russia, to what end? You know, I mean, if he's trying to defeat the Soviet Union, he sure as shit pretty much had it done halfway through the autumn of 1941. You know what I mean? I mean, he destroyed most of the army. He just was. Both him and Stalin were maniacal, evil, and ultimately foolish guys. I mean, he was riding a horse with some strong, you know, horses underneath him, and they were gonna. It would have been rough. There's no way the Russians would have won if we hadn't been in this war. Right. It's ridiculous.
No
way they wouldn't have had enough coats. They wouldn't have had enough bullets or nothing like that. And we should know, we saw the Russian gear at its best in 1991, and it sucked. You know, it sucked, and it sucked in 1940s too.
It's always sucked.
Yeah,
it sucks today. It sucks today.
Yeah,
you know, compare any time you know American gear gets stacked up against Russian gear, you know, they suck.
Yeah, and I'm not. I mean, they got good because it was fuck or walk. You know what I mean? Right. It was do or die. And because Hitler's going to kill them all eventually, you know, if he won. And Stalin, I mean, I don't know who's worse, the Russians or the Germans. I mean, they made a deal to stab Poland in the back, you know, in 1939, right before Hitler invaded Poland. And Stalin couldn't believe that his buddy Hitler had invaded him in June of 1941. He didn't believe it for like 2-3 weeks. You know, he couldn't believe that he couldn't make a deal with the guy. They weren't really military guys. They're just shitheads. If you're five guys are standing on the street talking, and all this, it's pretty, you know, more or less cordially, and then two guys, they kick the guys in the balls and poke them in the eyes. Does that make them military geniuses? No, it makes them pricks, man. And when the other three guys get their shit together, they're gonna trash them. And I mean, in an oversimplified way, to me, that's kind
of
like.
It sounded like an episode of the Three Stooges, honestly.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, well, hey, what did Barbara Tuchman call the 1914-1918 war, the March of Folly. I mean, the Second World War is a little bit easier to predict, but no less filled with stupid mistakes. And Tim named some of them on our side. It probably wasn't a good idea to invade, Italy. They thought it was going to be an easy target. It turned out to be, you know, basically a meat grinder.
Oh, no, it was a stupid idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, you know, I'll tell you what.
Some of the other things that we did. What the hell was that? Was that the raid that we did on the?
No. We're getting off the subject. We're not doing a broad brush analysis of the whole Second World War. I was flabbergasted because you don't learn, you don't learn anything about the Eastern Front other than Germany invades and.
Well, I'm surprised you learned anything about the Western Front. Because I sure shit didn't.
When you were growing up?
My history, when I was in school, ended pretty much around the post-Civil War time frame.
I was just a reader. I mean,
too.
Right?
I think all three of us were. Right. And all our buddies at IOC.
But everything.
Most of the infantry guys we trained.
But this is when. I'm talking about when you're a kid. And so, as you come of age, you come in the Marine Corps. And you meet people that are readers, and not everybody was when we joined the Marine Corps. And then you begin to read, and you begin to learn about the battles on the Eastern Front. I have hanging in my garage one of those maps that's actually wallpaper, because I used to go looking for like topographical maps of Eastern Europe when I was reading about the Eastern Front, because you hear about all these places like Smolensk and Wittbach and the battles that Guderian would get into, blah 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 blah. But if you don't, in my opinion, if you don't have a map, and Google Earth wasn't invented, you can't understand it. And so I would go to used bookstores, and they'd always have a section where they have a stack of maps, and I would go in there. And I would look for maps. And then finally I saw this in a catalog. I saw this wallpaper. And the reason I bought it was that because it was a topographical map. It wasn't just a political map. There wasn't that many maps of Eastern Europe. And so I'd sit with this thing and I'd have tacks on the map and you could see like, holy shit, Guderian's sticking his neck out. And that's why Smolensk is so important. But anyway. So you begin to read about that, and the Eastern Front is just this gigantic, fight. And then it's like, okay, so what is the American contribution, and where does Normandy fit into all of this? And our contribution was simply not on our border. Our contribution was our global contribution, right, as you talk about. I mean, all the things that happened simultaneous to this – All that we're doing industrially, our Navy around the world, right? Was there any such thing as a Russian Navy? No. The Russians and their snarky ass, comment yesterday, shut the fuck up, man. You would not even exist today, right? No. You'd be speaking German right now, right?
Well, do you remember when we were kids? Do you remember this? In the 60s. And later, there was this show called Victory at Sea. Yeah. I mean, it's the first documentary I remember seeing about the Second World War. It was mainly about the Pacific. But then, around the time we started watching, we started getting Monty Python in the early 70s, we got this show called The World at War, narrated by Laurence Olivier. I was glued to that thing. Me and my friends, because we weren't getting what we were looking for from the high school history classes. Some of the teachers were only interested in talking about Watergate, And we're 14-year-old kids. Who gives a shit about Nixon and stuff? But I remember that Winds of War, they did. They were equally, interested in what happened on the Eastern Front, probably because so many Brits are communists, But they did an outstanding piece on Stalingrad and Leningrad, and the whole thing that worked in there. And that leads you to things when you're a kid. Because let's face it, to learn history, you're pretty much self-taught in America. And so that stuff led me to, finding books like The Winds of War and War and Remembrance, which is fiction by Herman Wouk, who wrote The Cane Mutiny and stuff. But it's fiction that provides windows to you to go and explore stuff. everything from the way the Holocaust was engineered to those big battles on the Eastern Front, what it was like in the first part of the invasion of the Soviet Union, what it was like in Poland, you know, when Hitler first invaded there, you know, and the wars, the fighting in the Pacific and so forth. So it was like, you know, America is a free place, and it also is a commercial place, and it was commercially lucrative for people to put that stuff out there. You remember those little Ballantine books you used to see in the stores?
Wait. Hold on. Before you give us the literary and the documentary history of World War II, finish your fucking point, man.
My point is there's plenty of education out there for us on both fronts, all the way through the 70s. How old are you? You're like 5 or 6 years younger than me, right?
I'm 61.
Out there, man. It just wasn't taught in schools. But there's a list. Even when we went to school, it wasn't that much better than it is now, and it sucks now. So, I mean,
no, the only reason I was always I was even cognizant of the European theater was on July 4th in our hometown, they had one of those ducks that would go through.
Right.
And I remember they would say, oh, that was like from Normandy in World War II. But mm-hmm. but that's interesting because, as I was mentioning before we came on, I did a little impromptu poll around here asking folks if they knew what June 6th was. And not one person. One person identified that June 6th and D-Day had something to do with Saving Private Ryan, but he thought that was about Vietnam, so he don't even count. So it's interesting what Jeff said. The fact that you know anything about this stuff at all, and there's so much to learn about it, it's almost like you got to be self-taught. That's a great point.
No, well, I'll tell you what, and then you read about it, right? And you read, you know, like the reaction in Germany when they got told that the Eighth Army no longer existed. Right? The utter disbelief that, what was it like? The Eighth Army was like, you know, like, what, half a million?
260. Yeah, 260,000.
Yeah, and you're like,
are you talking about the guys at Stalingrad?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the Sixth Army.
Sixth Army. Paulus's Army. Sixth Army, yeah.
All right.
94,000 guys marched into captivity. Less than 5,000 came home.
Yeah. I mean, and that goes out at some point over the airwaves of Germany. And people are just like, what? I mean, they were laying the wood to Stalingrad.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, the mousetrap snapped back on them. What happened? I mean, just the disbelief, you know, and so, I mean, amazing stuff. No, but so, to me, you know, so, and then it causes you to question, like, well, wait a minute. My conception of World War II was this. There's something going on before 1941, right? Pearl Harbor happens. We do some shit in the Pacific, Guadalcanal and shit. Then we go to North Africa, right? And then in Italy. And then we do Normandy. We're fighting across the Pacific. And we defeat Germany. We defeat Japan. And then when you throw the Eastern Front into it, you're like, oh, well, maybe, you know, maybe it didn't happen like exactly the way I thought of it in my head. And then you begin to rethink it. And then you look at, you know, so what is the American contribution? The American contribution is every theater, right? Right. Every nation that fought the American, you know, the United States is beginning to fulfill, if I could use the term manifest destiny, as an industrial power and premieres on the stage as the world power, right? It's economic might, it's industrial might, right? Our population, it makes its debut, right? And in this whole period, as the preeminent global power.
You know, I gotta caution you on one thing. When you start talking about manifest destiny, that leads directly to goddamn dodgeball with children, and you know, you can't be having that. But
come
in all seriousness,
was there anything more fun than playing dodgeball in gym? Come on, that was a good time.
No, I know. It's verboten now. It apparently has something to do with establishing hierarchies or something.
It's like the lame kids get hit. They have low self-esteem because of it.
Yeah. No, but you know, when you think about it, within 5 years, because I don't understand how in 1944, with two invasions going simultaneously, we've got 26 carriers, and this is just on these two invasions. There's other ships out there operating at the same time. 23 battleships, 46 cruisers, 190 destroyers. That's just on. Where the hell did that all come from? That is mind-boggling to think that we did that.
Well, that's a Iwo Jima. Every regiment had their own battleship, and every battalion had their own.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it is unbelievable how he responded, and I don't even understand how the hell we did it, and I don't think we could do it today. I'd like to think we could.
You couldn't do it today. It would take a couple of years.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it did take that long to convert, right? But we had the industrial capacity, the steel making capacity, you know, to convert.
We got a head start in the late 30s and 40s. It wasn't like people didn't see it coming. I mean, you got to admit to that.
Right.
But that's, I mean, Jesus, it's taken us 6 years to digitize the DD-214. Come on, man.
Yeah, I love that story. What the hell?
Yeah,
there's that card.
We did these, these things that were insoluble problems. Put a man on the moon, do all that stuff that we did, Second World War onward. Yet now we can't keep a bunch of bums off the North Beach here in San Clemente. Somehow these problems are insurmountable.
Exactly. We can't sync the DOD medical records with the VA medical records. It's like billions of dollars in 2 decades, and we can't do it. Like, what the hell? Interesting. Anything else about Normandy that... okay, let me ask you two guys some trivia questions. Normandy trivia. You ready?
Yeah.
How many... let me get to my trivia page, my Normandy trivia page. How many on the U.S. side, on the Allied side, how many troops involved?
I'd say about, 130,000.
Tim?
I'd say maybe 70,000,
80,000. No, I'm cheating. I've got the page up. Hold on, I'm going to get off this page. I'm not going to cheat. I would say we're somewhere in the neighborhood of 120,000.
156,000.
That's count, and that's guys who hit the beach, or is that everybody?
156,115 men landed on D-Day. This comprised 57,500 Americans, 75,215 British and Canadians from the sea, and then, hold on, let me just...
24,000 total from the air.
Right, from the sea, and 15,500 Americans and 8,000 Brits from the air.
Right.
Yeah. And then there was another almost 200,000 naval personnel off the coast.
Right.
So again, you're talking about 350,000, members of the military involved in the operation. How many Germans did they face?
I think 350,000 guys total.
I recall it was a one-on-one, wasn't it? Just about average?
I think we outnumbered them pretty, all that shit that Mac mentioned together.
In Normandy. In Normandy, they said there was 50,350.
In Normandy itself.
Casualties. How many how many Allied casualties?
Well, I think about less than 300 actual KIA during the airborne stuff, but a shitload of wounded and missing, like in the thousands. And then on the beach, of course, Omaha was the worst. I don't think they even had 300 KIA at Utah. But Omaha, for the Americans, was the worst with pretty much like a Tarawa type casualty count, almost 1,000 dead.
All right, so give me a swag. Total casualties connected with D-Day.
I'd say 2,500 dead and maybe or 2,200 dead and 15,000 wounded.
4,400 confirmed dead.
Right.
And then 10,000 plus total, so another 5,600 wounded, 185 Sherman tanks destroyed.
How many of you made to the beach?
I thought.
Doesn't
they're
say
using those DD
curious.
Tanks? Those,
the ones that had the skirts on them are supposed to swim ashore.
Yeah, right. Duplex drive or something like that, and a lot of them just foundered right away, but a lot of them made it. I mean, but. You know, they're like sitting ducks there for sure.
The,
and that's a British invention, by the way, that duplex whatever.
Yeah.
DB tanks.
Anybody tries to ever stick you in a tank that they say swims, get out of it. It volunteer somebody else for it. Volunteer somebody else. The I'll tell you what. A friend of mine, well, the chef who comes on Friday, his dad flew a C-47. In the Normandy invasion. And had a real interesting conversation. So in the Band of Brothers scene, right, where they show those guys flying, to me that was unbelievable. Because, I mean, the detail that they did, you know, the time they devoted to developing them flying, right, and then, you know, here you train for years, right, and you see these guys going, these airplanes going down, and these guys not even getting a chance to fight, and you're just watching it going, holy shit, you're seeing, you know, planes getting the, you know, shit shot out of them, right? They're wearing soft covers, right? They're flying with a speed gauge and an altitude gauge and not a whole lot more. You know, the pilots have on steel pots and shit like that. And you're just like watching. I remember talking to him about it. He said, yeah, when I saw that, I couldn't believe it. I'd never seen anything like that. You know, I knew my dad did it, but I had no idea what the experience would have been like. So Tom Hanks, right, and Steven Spielberg deserve a shit ton of credit for recreating, right, realistic footage and giving, you know, a generation of Americans that have watched it an incredible appreciation for what those guys went ashore and did. And those, you know, I'm a huge fan of Band of Brothers for a lot of reasons. But they continued the realistic stuff they started in Saving Private Ryan,
right, in
that series, and then took it to the Pacific, and it's incredibly rich, I think, with lessons and whatnot. What a final thought on Normandy, Jeff?
Oh, me. I think we proved we could do it once, but I really don't know if we could do it again. And I think about that a lot, especially when times like this come up, anniversaries and so forth. You know, I really don't know if we could do that again now. Now, I don't even know if we could have done it in 1942, if you know what I mean. It took kind of like a toughening of the couple years before that, you know, to be able to do that. But now, from what I see, I just don't know. I just don't know if... And I look out there for an enemy that would be, you know, relative to the way we are now, as formidable as the Germans and the Japanese. And I think they're out there. And I don't know if we've got the sand right now to tackle it as a nation like we did then.
Yeah, and you think back to the nation back there. That, you know, the nation wanted no part of another conflict in Europe, right? I mean, FDR the line he walked with the Lend-Lease and the overwhelming sentiment because of the in the country was we don't want any part of another European war. And you're watching, you know, and I was talking about this the other day. I mean, when you don't confront totalitarianism, right, and in big power competition, when you don't confront that, all you're doing is putting off the date that you will confront it or you will be dominated by it. And so I look at China. And I look at China, and that's what I see. If you won't confront China in all the stupid shit that they do and they say, if you won't do what the president does politically, which is every time somebody says it, you fight it.
Yeah.
With the Chinese, then all you're doing to them is ceding them more control and making the day that you do reconcile worse. And so the economic confrontation that we're having with China is absolutely required. The confrontation that is going to take place in the South China Sea should be the confrontation between free democracies and their navies and the Chinese. And the Chinese have to know if you're going to live in this world with the rest of us, there's certain rules that you got to live by. And you can't simply redesign the game because you've decided to. And if we and our allies won't haven't learned anything from history, you know, hopefully we learn that, and that you have to stand up and not be pushed, you know, because at someday you're going to have to push back, and all you're doing is going to make it worse.
Yeah. Well, we thought we learned that. And then when we stood in the door against, you know, basically Stalin gave the green light for the, you know, for the Koreans and the Chinese to try to take South Korea. And, you know, we fought them off, but, you know, there was a weak response from our allies, a little bit of one. Then the response is non-existent during Vietnam. It's essentially the same thing, done a little bit more subtly, but same thing. And right now the lines that we have in the United States, the partisan lines are drawn based on the conflicts we had during the Cold War. The willingness to face the reality that you just mentioned is denied, you know, by whatever party's not actually in power. And, you know, we're almost like the Carthaginians during Hannibal, where one political party is selling the nation down the road for political gain, you know, momentarily political gain, while, the actual things like you just mentioned are at hazard.
Yeah, you know, I still have, and to me the quintessential example of that in my lifetime is Harry Reid standing up for political gain, saying the war is lost.
Yeah.
The only reason he said that, the only reason he said that was to score political points. And hopefully win the presidency for the Democrats in, 2008 or whenever the hell he was saying.
No, that was 2004 he said that. Yeah,
and it's... No, it was after 2004. It was after I'd come home once, at least.
Well, maybe it was for the 2006 thing. I think that's when it was, for the midterms. Because that's what changed the whole, that's what caused the surge.
Right.
Rid of Rumsfeld and so forth. So it might have been that. Right. But you're right, he did say that. Right. For that reason.
Right. And you're watching it. And then, it was 2006, right? Because we found DVDs that were made. And they had Reed's picture and videotape in them, right, with the, you know, their music in it. And they were their propaganda shit to their fighters. Hey, keep killing the Americans. And they'd show all these, you know, headshots, you know, videotape of that. Because in case you don't know, when they're looking to produce videos, they would go out with guys who had IDs put in and they would videotape, right, vehicles getting blown up.
That's why whenever we saw a guy with a video camera, we started shooting at him in 2006.
and that's exactly
what it was.
And so, and you find that stuff, and, you know, and you're reading the reports on it, because I couldn't understand it. And it's like, this guy is the number, whatever Harry Reid was, five guy in line for the presidency. He is the leader of the senior house, in the American government. And he is saying that the war is lost. Keep killing them. They will quit just like they quit in Korea, just like they quit in Vietnam, just like they quit in Lebanon, just like they quit in Somalia. They will quit. So he's providing, right, sustainment for the enemy. And so, but
going back to D-Day, I just found a ray of hope, some optimism in what you're saying. Because when you think of D-Day, the complexities involved, multi-nation operation, as I mentioned, you had political interference with the operational planning, at least to some degree, but you had people doing genius stuff like developing those mulberries that they used in order to offload all the supplies and things like that. Right. You had nations forced to cooperate because they were confronting a common enemy. I just submit to you that possibly if ever again we confront a common enemy en masse with our European brothers, that we would be able to work and cooperate again. I have not high hopes for such, by the way. I'm just trying to find the silver lining here because I just feel optimism that it's my evening on All Marine Radio.
So one of the issues is the Brits want to use Wu Wei, right, as their provider for 5G technology. And it's like, are you fucking stupid?
Yeah.
it doesn't matter. Hey, buddy, we already changed movies because of China. I'm sorry, I'm talking to the guy who interviews Alex Hollins.
Do you remember, what's the think tank at Stanford? The Hoover Institute,
right?
Yeah.
The Hoover Institute puts out a report, and it's all these people that are steeped in Chinese research. They're married, half of them are married to Chinese women, okay? And what they say is the United States needs to increase its vigilance relative to China. They are infiltrating our universities. They are contributing money. They're infiltrating in Hollywood. So their design is to reshape, and it was interesting, there was stories talking about how they've reshaped their own history, and they've written Tiananmen Square out of it to include completely, right, obliterating structurally any trace of anything that had to do with Tiananmen Square, right, which is the totalitarian way. Yeah, we really can't square that, so we'll say it never happened. And
that's correct. They're erasing it.
Right. And so, anyway, you see that stuff, and you're just like, how, if we, again, I mean, this is the lesson of World War II, is if left unchecked, if you think you can make deals with these people, the only way to deal with them is peace through strength and peace through strong alliances. And
but you've got one nationally prominent political figure who's willing to toe the line with China, and God bless him, the people are supporting the president, and I honestly believe we've got another 4 years after his first term, but after he's done, brother, the standard response from the Republicans and Democrats before has always been, yeah, just China, what the hell? Why would we be afraid of China? We can work with them. I mean, geez, the premier looks just like a panda. He's a friendly looking fella. I mean, come on.
That's right? What Joe Biden says. Come on, man.
Exactly.
Yeah, we can work with them. You know, and sure. you're watching it, and as you get sensitized to it, you're like, you look at it, and you're like, you got to be kidding me, man. And I mean, look, the Secretary of Defense in the UK, he quit or resigned, and he was accused of leaking, saying that, yeah, the Americans are right. We should not allow Huawei to be part of our 5G infrastructure, right? We shouldn't do that, right? And then he got told to shut up and color. That story somehow or other got leaked, his dissent and the things he said, and then he was told to quit. Okay, so what's the truth? What's the truth? So, anyway.
Truth, there's a lot of EU disease out there, that's why.
Yeah, and that is, and here's why politicians, you know, make deals with totalitarian, well, here's why modern politicians make deals with China. Because China's economy is so big, and it floats a portion of your economy. So when you tell China, hey, you need to stop doing this shit, right? They say, you know what, we're really not. And if you keep this up, if you keep talking about it, we're going to stop importing, right, steel, whatever, or pork bellies, whatever, from your ass, Australia. And guess what's going to happen to you, right? Your economy's going to go in the tank, or part of it will. Unemployment's going to increase, and you're going to get voted out of office. So at the end of the day, what drives a politician is, and what, in my opinion, what absolutely drove Barack Obama was, I don't need that ass pain economically. I need to learn how to get along with them. I cannot stand up for free economies, right, free navigation of the sea, right, and being treated as an equal in this world trade. So that I can't push back against the Chinese, because otherwise our economy is going to suffer. That'll cost me in the polls.
Yeah, he's a regular guy.
Right.
You need an above average guy to be president.
No, but the scope of the problem is specifically when you're talking Australia. My daughter Megan, my oldest daughter, graduated from college down there, and I watched online live her ceremony. She graduated a law school. And so she was with the foreign students, because she was not obviously an Australian or whatnot. I watched them go through 3 hours of Chinese names, and then Megan Lynch, boom, off she went, and we went right back to another 45 minutes of Chinese names.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah, no,
And the Australian woman doing it spoke them perfectly, too. I was most impressed that she could roll them off. But it was hours, and I'm like, Megan, how many Chinese people? She goes, well, half the school's Chinese. They pay full tuition. Everybody loves to have Chinese students, right? Same with American universities.
No, it's a big deal. It's a big deal in Australia because again, the Chinese way, and then the Chinese tell their citizens abroad, you are always Chinese first.
They're monitored abroad. They monitor their social network, everything. No, it's not a very they are not our friends, and I don't believe we should make a big efforts to work with them.
And my point in saying this is that, you know, when you look at, you know, 75 years ago, we had to go unscrew something that we put off in the late 30s because nobody wanted to go back to war. And so when Germany began to violate the conditions of the armistice, rather than understanding if we don't keep this in a can, right, it's going to consume Europe again. And so this is pennies to pounds, right? And rather than understanding, you know, peace through strength, you know, we accommodate totalitarian governments, which never, ever historically works out well.
And it's like, it's not like you're saying we should have had the Holocaust of 1940, the early 1940s and the 1930s, because it wouldn't have been that if people stuck up to him early. I mean, that's the absolute truth. The guy is an opportunist, and he was pushing his stuff. You know, if we had stuck up to him in 1935, 1936, when he was starting to, you know, shove, you know, material down in the Spanish Civil War, and then taking over Czechoslovakia in 1938 and so forth. If we had done shit then, you know, you're right. We wouldn't have had and that should be the lesson that we have now, you know.
It's 75 years later. Right, 75 years later, think about that. The United States transitioned from a power that helped out Europe in World War II to become the dominant global power in the nation. And our alliance, and one of the cool things that has been on display this week, right, was our relationship with England, right? And that the architecture that we created in conjunction with England is what has created this world that we've certainly lived in, and with the exception of the Soviet Union and Stalin's hold and now Putin's hold on that, you know, much of the world can decide for itself what it wants to be. And you know, and you can economically develop and be what you want to be. Other than, you know, probably, I don't know, there's a list of, what, a handful of countries that still have dictators and kings and shit like that.
It's a shitload, man.
Right.
It's called from Morocco to Malaysia. Every Muslim country, there's not one that's a representative democracy. Not one.
That's what, the fourth world, the fifth world? I mean, whatever. My point is this. That our relationship with England has us ushered in economic growth for the world on a scale that nobody could ever have imagined. And if I don't understand how we as nations are not mindful of, and I look at Germany, how Germany is not mindful of its responsibility to the rest of Europe to carry its own burden as the greatest economy on the continent relative to defense, to the common defense, because the only way you could sustain peace is through strength. And how they think they can just let everybody else defend them, and because they're German, fuck that.
Well, if you gave your daughter a brand new Porsche, how well you think she'd treat that car in like 6 months?
I don't know.
Right?
Well, daughter, she
gave it to her. That's the thing with Germany.
She's afraid of me, so she better treat it good.
No, what I mean is that, you know, we've always provided that umbrella to Europe and Germany and whatnot. We've always shouldered that burden for free. And did they appreciate it? No. We're not that popular in Germany. We're not that popular in England.
Human nature lesson since the end of the Second World War. To give.
Yeah, we're not that popular.
To be generous is to be despised.
Yeah, it is. And so you've got to keep that in mind also. It makes you wonder if something were to break out like that again in Europe, there'd be a lot of this country just like there was in 1940 that would be saying, "Hey, let them kill each other. What do we care? They're Europe. They're it's not our problem. We got the Atlantic Ocean now with them." There'd be people today saying that. There probably are, for crying out loud.
It's just stunning. Honestly, it's so stunning because, you know,
All you're asking for is a repeat of the event.
That's right. And all Americans are asking for, I mean, honestly, is let's just all get along and let's do business. And generally, we don't screw you. I mean, you know, as a general rule.
No, but you both alluded to it earlier. But you know, and I said this a couple weeks ago. But people, you know, when you talk about Barack Obama's foreign policy relative to Iran, relative to North Korea, relative to China and the South China Sea and China and economics and relative to Russia, it's like there's no way that we could have had a weaker foreign policy as a nation. When you say that, and again, you guys know, I'm not too much of a partisan. I'm a conservative. But I think I'm a man of reason. But when people, you say that, people look at you and their jaw drops like, what?
No, dude, what did Barack Obama give the Queen of England as a present when he met her?
His own iPod or something like that, with his own
speeches. iPod loaded with his own speeches. Now remember, he's the son of a guy that was an implacable enemy of the crown and an absolute anti-British, anti-colonialist, African revolutionary. Barack Obama, do you think for a second?
I don't want to go off on Barack Obama. I'm talking about people's reaction to the fact that.
I'm just saying, as far as politicals go, that you couldn't have done a perfect thing to the Queen.
Yeah, no, well, mass media is losing its grip on our opinion. Stuff because it used to be they told you how to think, you know, and now no one, there's less and less people believe them when they do that. So, like, when you say stuff about Obama now, and like, I understand I wouldn't want to get into a discussion about him either, but the guy, they're trying to stoke veneration for this guy, and it's just not there with a lot of people.
Well, no, but my point is that when you look at where the nation was, and if you go back to the creation of ISIS, you go back to what he did relative with Iran, right? There's this, in every step he takes, it's yeah, we're wrong, you know, you're right, you know, we'll accommodate you. And when you're a dictator, all you have to do is look at the United States and say, you can have a deal with us, but these are the terms. We can sign it. We can have a big toast, right? You're going to get screwed, the United States, but you can have a deal. That's what the Chinese are going to do. They're not going to make. They're not cut any deal with Donald Trump, because if they cut a deal on intellectual property, if they cut a deal on forced transfer of technology, that jeopardizes the whole franchise. And so what they'll do is they'll wait, and you can tell the Americans, well, you can have a deal, but this is what it looks like. And if we and if we stand up on our hind legs and say no, you know, the Koreans are doing the same thing. And they'll wait for the election, and they'll hope, you know, that Uncle Joe gets elected. He'll go there with his hat on his hand, and they'll say, okay, these are the terms, and Joe will sign, right? He'll sign two agreements, and you know, we see the future to totalitarianism, and that's never a good thing. But
that's for sure. I guess for all you folks out there listening. Don't vote for Joe Biden. Vote for President Trump.
Oh, he's there. He will be. They're running Biden because they can't beat Trump. Because Biden's a sacrificial lamb. He's not going to win.
Well, you know what? I don't know about any of that. But I know that the lesson 75 years ago was that this country and our allies paid a huge price for our lack of vigilance and our lack of strength in the late 30s. And I just don't understand how free nations don't say, you know what, we got that memo. We've got to invest in our own defense, because what can China do when the Australian Navy, the Japanese Navy, the South Korean Navy, right, the Philippine Navy, right, all join the United States Navy and the Indian Navy, all join the United States and the British Navy, all join the United States and say, we're not having it. We're not doing it that way. There's nothing they can say.
Not a chance. Yeah, there's nothing.
They'll fuck with the Indians.
Right.
right. I mean,
it'll be asymmetrical.
So the lesson 75 years ago is that you pay expensive prices if you won't be vigilant.
And I don't know. Again, these things, like how the UK can promote Wu Wei as a world leader in 5G technology and not think that sewn into that technology is the ability of the Chinese intelligence service to take whatever they want. And the Brit comeback to that is, oh no, our blokes are good enough. We'll figure it all out. I mean, come on. James Bond is our guy. We know how to do it. And it's bullshit. And it's bullshit. So
anyway, absolutely.
Well, 4 years after the CIA lost every asset they had in China, after they got exposed because of some bullshit the CIA had as far as the software for their agents to use, but the Chinese penetrated that software and rolled up every one of them after it slipped out that we had something to do with the sex tent virus. I don't want to bitch about Obama's. I'm not going to mention how that slipped out. But it's not that long ago that, within the National Security Agency's, the number one priority from what, 2012 to 2014 was what the hell happened to all our agents in Asia, China and Iran. I mean, it was the number one issue. And now it's like nobody remembers that. Nobody even recognizes
that. I have to tell you something. I think, I know we're talking Normandy, so I don't want to get into it, but I think a lot of stuff that's going on with the Attorney General is causing, trepidation on the Democratic side because exactly that, Tim. The stuff that could come out has so much far-reaching stuff that could come spilling out, like crap.
Shut up! Jeff, you're talking about the Attorney General's investigation into how the Trump dossier was developed and used and disseminated. Yes, that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, how come that happened? Right. So that's going to lead to how come you investigated this guy based on this, but the other candidate you didn't investigate based on all this obvious evidence you had. What was the reason for that? And so sooner or later somebody starts talking, and then that leads to, well, the Attorney General before Loretta Lynch, and that leads to why. So what really happened with the IRS? Because all that stuff was buried by Mueller on orders of Holder. We're not going to investigate. Not even a smidgen of corruption with the IRS thing. And that Fast and Furious thing, that was just an anomaly, Don't worry about that. Yeah, we lost a guy, but, we always lose guys. And so you don't know how deep the crap is. And this thing with the vice president and his kid and involvement in China, especially his kid making, I think in the billions almost for his company based on he flies with his dad to China, while he was vice president. I mean, there's just so much. You don't want to be paranoid, but you're thinking to yourself, why are they so, adamant pushing this obviously phony collusion thing? And to me, look, as a tactician, I'm thinking this is just a spoiling attack. They know as soon as they stop, doing their patrols, this is like patrols against the defense, then the offense is going to come at them.
All right. So let's stop the black helicopter discussion right now. Dion, any final thoughts about 75 years later, confronting totalitarianism, Normandy, as we kind of get out the door? Tim?
No, I think we've hit it pretty hard. The lessons are there for those who want to learn them. There's no question about that.
Yeah, I guess my Jeff already gave his point, but I guess my final point would be something that Jeff kind of talked about. We were all readers as kids,
right?
As Jeff said, we would watch Rat Patrol and
combat and
all the things we could watch because we had this, all of us uniquely had a thirst for history. I remember my mom taking us to the library and I would go to the history aisle and I'd look at books and, she'd take books out for me and the Scholastic Book Club at my grammar school. I think I bought every World War II, book that you could read, I bought and read them. And so to me, I mean, there's incredible merit in that in terms of the intellectual development of anybody and encourage that with your kids. Because, again, you look at the price we paid in World War II, and you look at the cemeteries in Europe, and you look at the cemeteries in the Pacific, and you go to Arlington, and that's a lot of people who their only life went away because we were not mindful enough and courageous enough to confront totalitarianism where it needed to be confronted. And I don't care if it's in Iran, and if they want a confrontation, then we should confront them. And I don't care if it's with China, but the free democracies of this world, right, if they're not up to the task, I mean, it's going to be a sorry-ass world. And at some point, there will be a confrontation, and then maybe somebody imposes their will on you as the United States because you don't want to do the heavy lifting that it takes to sustain this unique gift of democracy and freedom that is a beacon around the world. And we know it is such because we've been around the world and we've seen what it represents. And it needs to be maintained, but you can't maintain it from a position of weakness. You can only maintain it from a position of strength. And so, I guess that's what's in my head, is that that's a lot, that's a big price to pay for not being vigilant in the late 30s and standing up and enforcing the Treaty of Versailles. And maybe we should have gone back to the table and renegotiated that son of a bitch, right? And said, okay, Germany, you're right. These terms are too onerous. And maybe we would have had somebody like George Marshall near the table, because that guy was an unbelievable, you know, an unbelievable gift to the United States and to Europe, and what he did in not only during the war but after the war, and he's probably, you know, we should probably next week let's talk about Marshall and the Marshall Plan.
Yeah, because it's a good idea.
We're touching on
it up like a true trooper to stay in as a leader back in the United States. What a remarkable man. Remarkable man.
Right.
One thing, though, that we kind of touched on without even mentioning them, the League of Nations and then the United Nations, because those are both stabs at trying to deal with what you were driving at, Mac, on your last comments there. And they failed. And the League of Nations failed time and again, all the way from the 20s, dealing with the Chinese crisis there that they had, and then in through the Japanese aggression in the early 30s, up to and including the Spanish Civil War. Time and again, they were looked at to intervene with the Czechoslovakia thing, and this was an organization meant to expressly, you know, do what you were saying.
And prevent.
And it just didn't work.
I think the fatal flaw of the organization, though, is totalitarian members have veto powers.
Right.
Exactly right.
And so to me, they ought to be expelled. It should be an organization of free nations, not totalitarian. So if you're a king or whatever, we'll do business with you on a transactional basis. If we need you, we will ally with you. But you can't be a part of this because this is free nations, right, that join together to prevent bad things from happening. And there's no fucking way that you're going to have a veto over what free nations on this planet decide that is in the best interest of their freedom and their economic prosperity. So fuck you.
You're right. And, you know, and to your point, Marshall is just the guy for us to talk about that, because here's a guy who is influential for his rank from World War One all the way up through World War Two and beyond, serving both as Secretary of Defense and, you know, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs before there was one, right, and also Secretary of State. During that whole time when both those organizations, the first one failed and the second one basically got off to where you're talking about now. So I think that would be a great vehicle for next time.
No, he's incredible. I had the director of the George Marshall Center on, which is, it's at VMI, I think. Yeah, because Dave Furness.
He's the VMI guy.
Right? Yeah, Dave Furness won the George Marshall Award when he was a senior. I bust his balls for that. One of the things that I didn't know about General Marshall was, the programs, the economic aid that we sent to Europe, after the war, wasn't simply economic aid. So we sent them refrigerators. We sent them washing machines.
Right.
It was the mechanism that he soft-landed the American economy by transitioning, right, tank factories to refrigerator factories to washing machine factories. So when you hear that and you think him thinking in, like, the complete thought, right, will help them rebuild, but this will also provide the soft landing for an economy.
He reverse engineered the American economy onto them.
Right, which is, it's amazing. Yeah, so his genius, and again, just an unassuming, probably one of the most powerful men the United States has ever known in terms of intellect, in terms of long-range planning, grand strategy, if you will, and matching economic might to that. I mean, Marshall is really, we've never had anybody like him. MacArthur in the Pacific, right? Except MacArthur he's a doofus, right?
He's a megalomaniac.
Yeah, he's a narcissistic. He was effective. He's a narcissist, crazy dude. Man.
Yeah, he's a Caesar wannabe. Whereas Marshall is a
middle combat experience.
You know what I mean? He had veneration for our institutions. Whereas MacArthur and some people like him, they're men on horseback. You know, they're looking for individual glory. But Marshall wasn't. You know, Marshall was basically almost like George Washington in that he's going to do right by the organization, by the institution, by the country. Kind of like Cincinnatus, the guy in ancient Rome, you know, who gave up power even though it was given to him because they're in a state of emergency. And that's what, you know, that's the type of guy who provides longevity for a representative form of government, for sure.
I think the parallel of Marshall to Washington is accurate. Washington's selflessness and his concern for the nation. Marshall, but as you said, Jeff, between being chief of staff of the army and essentially chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and then as Secretary of Defense, and then as Secretary of State, he was the architect, right?
Mm-hmm.
Of the, you know, Pax Americana or whatever you want to call what rebuilt Western Europe and has turned Western Europe into what it is today. The keel was laid by George Marshall in the way he learned from the Treaty of Versailles and vowed that we're not going to make these mistakes again. And then he operationalized it. He did it all. So, all right.
He's a patron saint of Volkswagen, Volvo, and Peugeot. Without even knowing it.
He's you talk about an incredible life in terms of and far-reaching impact. It's just when you watch the events of the day, right, and you continue to see the Chinese assault on the post-World War II world that's been created. Right. And now I think everybody knows that with the size of China's economy, right, that China has to be accounted for, as does India. But, right, if we continue to allow them to play the emperor's new clothes and not stand up for what is right, it is only going to lead, in my opinion, to another calamity, right, somewhere down the road. And it might be 10, 15, 20 years down the road, but, you know, confront them. You know, confront them with your allies and do it from a position of strength and then give them a seat at the table, but they cannot have veto power. And that's why, to me, the United Nations, what good does it do?
Right.
When
you have Libya, the chairman, while Gaddafi was the king there, basically, president, they actually had control of the human rights council there, you know, it's ludicrous.
Right.
You know?
No, I mean, the United Nations, it's a worthless organization where people go to preen and to make statements, but it's not a working organization. It's certainly, the best thing the UN does is maybe get involved in humanitarian projects, and everybody goes, okay, yeah, we can agree to do that. But when the rubber meets the road and you need the League of Nations, as Wilson designed it, to prevent stuff fuck it. It ain't happening. And we all
yeah, and that guy got no love lost for President Wilson.
Well, that's a different, that'll be a different episode.
That's a different topic.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. Thanks, boys.
Thank you, sir.
Man, always a pleasure, Mac.
All right. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.